Gerard asks, what use is there for a money where you have to control your own password? Think about that for a second. He's telling you that the only form of digital money that could possibly be useful is one where you have to rely on a third party. Human rights activists should be wary of this kind of corporate mindset. Consider what is happening right now in China, where the Communist Party has loaded nearly the entire population onto systems like WeChat or Alipay, where they not only exert easy surveillance and control over your money and payments, but also steer you with powerful incentives and disincentives as part of the largest social engineering project in human history. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I'm Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What's up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are starting off the week with a read from Alex Gladstein, one of the many co-authors of the Little Bitcoin book, human rights activist, a huge, huge privacy advocate. I think we've read something from Alex on the show before. If I remember what it is or find it, I'll be sure to post it in the show notes. But I'm a huge fan of Alex's work, and this is one that kind of slipped by me, actually. Somebody else mentioned it in a thread, and I was like, oh, this is a great one. I immediately kind of dug into it, and I was like, oh, man, this definitely needs an audio piece. So it's titled A Human Rights Activist's Response to Bitcoin Critics. Real quick, though, a shout out to all of my patrons. Thank you so much for supporting the show. And, of course, Hexa Wallet, a great wallet for the people who are just coming into Bitcoin. It is seedless and uses Shamir secret sharing so that you can split up your backups among your friends and your contact list and lets you send Bitcoin directly to your contacts. They don't store any data. You don't have to set up an account. Nothing like that. You just download it and you're ready to go. And an offer I am extending to anyone who downloads the wallet, I will happily become a contact and be part of the backup, be a keeper for your backup so that it can be recovered if anything ever goes wrong with your phone. And of course, I'm always open for questions or anything like that. So hit me up on Twitter. DMs are open. And much love to Hexa Wallet for supporting the show. So let's go ahead and get into today's episode. Reading from Alex Gladstein, A Human Rights Activist's Response to Bitcoin Critics. Foreign Policy recently published the latest mainstream media attack on Bitcoin from the London-based author and journalist David Gerard. Gerard's Forget Bitcoin, Try Your Mattress is the newest in a long line of Bitcoin criticism published everywhere from the Financial Times to the Washington Post. This time, Bitcoin is part of a system, quote, plagued by hacks, fraud, and social engineering. Doesn't sound very appealing, does it? Why, might you ask, would a human rights activist like me be interested in something so universally derided by experts and the world establishment? This response is my answer. If you read along, we'll cover where the critics are right, why Bitcoin is secure and safe, how it does things that we can't do with our existing financial system, how it will scale and improve, why its monetary system is an improvement for many, why it's not a waste of energy, why progressives and libertarians should both be fans, why it matters for human rights, how we are at just the beginning of the Bitcoin journey, and why now is the best time to learn more and get involved. This essay is written from the point of view of someone who believes that mainstream Bitcoin critics don't actually understand how it works, meaning haven't done their homework and couldn't pass a basic quiz on topics like mining, wallets, or nodes, and are fulfilling the historical role of skeptics of a new technology early in its life cycle. There are two main varieties of Bitcoin critics: establishmentarians like Martin Wolf, who write from a place of fear. We don't want to see the existing financial system disrupted. And progressives like Gerard, who write from a place of disbelief, who don't believe decentralized money, Bitcoin could actually improve the world, just like decentralized government, democracy, and decentralized knowledge, the internet. Bitcoin critics do get many things right, as Gerard does in his foreign policy article. Too many actors in the cryptocurrency and blockchain space are actually charlatans or thieves. There is a huge amount of snake oil and hype, and many crypto exchanges are unsafe and wind up being hacked. The sad reality is that with the exception of a few valuable efforts like Monero, Zcash, and MakerDAO, whose teams and core values and driving missions of private money and censorship-resistant stable assets are critical even if they fail, most crypto projects are either intentional scams, unexciting modifications to existing technology, or wolves in sheep's clothing. Centralized systems which pretend to be decentralized, but still have back doors. The big mistakes of the critics, however, is to conflate this entire mess of an industry with Bitcoin, which, despite what Gerard and friends would have you believe, is the most secure form of money on the planet, and our first line of defense against the looming threat of mass social engineering and digital authoritarianism. Gerard's core Bitcoin critique centers on the Quadriga crisis, where $135 million of cryptocurrency was recently lost when the owner of an exchange died. While right to be alarmed about individuals losing huge sums of money, here is where Gerard makes a puzzling conflation. Losing your Bitcoin when it is controlled by someone else, in the Quadriga case, a sketchy company run entirely by one person, is like losing your money when thieves hack your bank account, or losing your jewelry if someone breaks into your security deposit box. In these cases, the security model of your bank is the problem, not the type of assets you own. And Bitcoin is no more responsible for the failure of a crypto exchange than the internet is responsible for the failure of the latest web startup. And yet, this line of attack is one that so many critics take when they try to blame scandals like Quadriga on Bitcoin and fool you into thinking that the project is one big scam. The community mantra, "not your keys, not your Bitcoin," is a constant reminder that you shouldn't allow someone else to control your Bitcoin. And Gerard even shares this phrase with his readers, but doesn't seem to appreciate the meaning. Users can have complete financial sovereignty over their Bitcoin, which is secured by public key cryptography. Simply put, if you don't have my private key, think password, you can't steal or spend my Bitcoin. This goes for thieves as well as giant companies, or even world powers, like the Chinese or American governments. No other form of money can boast this kind of security. In the title of his article, Gerard suggests that hiding money in your mattress would be safer. This is a bizarre argument to make when today you could instead store any amount of Bitcoin on a tiny USB stick or even a brain wallet, where you can memorize a backup phrase to your assets and cross borders with $1 billion in your head. Gerard asks, what use is there for a money where you have to control your own password? Think about that for a second. He's telling you that the only form of digital money that could possibly be useful is one where you have to rely on a third party. Human rights activists should be wary of this kind of corporate mindset. Consider what is happening right now in China, where the Communist Party has loaded nearly the entire population onto systems like WeChat or Alipay, where they not only exert easy surveillance and control over your money and payments, but also steer you with powerful incentives and disincentives as part of the largest social engineering project in human history. Control over our data and money will be an increasingly important part of keeping the internet and our societies free and open as we enter the age of mass surveillance and the cashless world. While it's true that you probably need to spend days or even weeks, think a boot camp or crash course, learning how to use Bitcoin before you can use it safely and properly, the fact is that this knowledge is available to anyone in the world online for free. If you would like to sacrifice the opportunity to personally control your Bitcoin for convenience, and you opt to use a third party to store your Bitcoin, then you can make that decision. but anyone now can choose to be their own bank. A game changer for the billions of people who don't control their own money. This is especially relevant outside of the advanced economies, where nearly all professional Bitcoin critics live. Gerard claims that Bitcoin takes us to the past, where you could, quote, lose your savings if your banker ran off with your money. The sad part is, this is not the past, but the dire present for people living in countries ranging from Iran to Zimbabwe to Venezuela, where governments recklessly print fiat currency, stealing from the hard-earned savings of the average person. In other places, including China, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, the government exerts total dictatorial control over the banking system, meaning your banker can, and often does, run off with your money whenever he wants. This is even true to an extent in advanced economies where the value of the dollar, inflated to pay for, among other things, global wars, has plummeted over the last few decades against other assets like oil and gold. Bitcoin doesn't take us backwards, but instead into the future, into a world where it will be much more difficult for governments and companies to control us. As far as Bitcoin's value proposition, one can certainly say that after its first decade, it's still a nascent technology, with a long way to go. It is not as private, fast, accessible, or approachable as it could and will be. But it's a considerable improvement already on at least one key function of our society, the wire, or ACH. Bitcoin is a big upgrade here, where for the first time one can send money to anyone else across the globe within minutes and without worry. Compare this to the existing model, where after sending a wire we sometimes have to wait days, pay big fees to third parties, and even wonder if the transaction will go through. Contrary to what the critics would have you believe with all of their scary language about fraud and risk, when I send an on-chain Bitcoin transaction to you, it will get to you, no matter what. There is no point of censorship, seizure, or control. Critics like to paint Bitcoin as a broken system, but actually, unlike Visa or MasterCard, which do break and go down from time to time, your access to Bitcoin can't be broken or censored, even if your government shuts down the internet. One of the most exciting developments in Bitcoin recently is the rise of satellite, mesh networking, and even radio infrastructure. Whether with a small satellite device or even over radio waves, you can send and receive Bitcoin from anywhere on Earth and beyond. And people are catching on. Already today, it is estimated that at least $6 trillion moved across the Bitcoin network in 2018, $3.2 trillion over exchanges, and 2 to 3 times that amount via OTC transfers. Compare that to $62 billion for Venmo or $8 trillion for Visa. Gerard says that the Bitcoin protocol is, quote, incredibly slow, anti-efficient, and hard to scale up, end quote. What he may not realize is that these are features, not bugs. Bitcoin's architects and ongoing community made an engineering trade-off at the base layer, choosing security and censorship resistance over speed. The good news is that there are second-layer technologies that people are building today that will allow large numbers of Bitcoin transactions to be batched together, potentially allowing Bitcoin to surpass our current financial system by orders of magnitude when it comes to speed and scaling. Gerard actually mentions one of these technologies, the Lightning Network, but calls it a toy that is already centralized. I would offer an alternative definition. Simply put, Lightning will allow hundreds, thousands, or one day, millions of payments to get batched together into one transaction on the underlying blockchain. Lightning payments are globally instantaneous. Watch the demonstration done by Coin Center in U.S. Congress. And in good news for privacy advocates, protected by Onion Routing, a robust encryption technology. So, while today, with enough resources, a government can surveil Bitcoin transactions by analyzing the blockchain and potentially hunt down dissidents, doing so on Lightning will be much more difficult, as payments will occur off-chain, routed in a way where the owners of the network's payment hubs don't know the origin or final destination of the payments which pass through them. As for whether or not lightning is centralized, the answer is easy. It's not. There is no single point of failure. You may have heard about lightning in the news lately as Twitter and Square CEO Jack Dorsey has said it is a matter of when, not if, Square will implement the network into its popular Cash App. This is an exciting step in the right direction for advocates of privacy and human rights. Girard also attacks Bitcoin for having a limited supply cap, meaning there won't be more than 21 million Bitcoin ever, and more than 17 million are already in circulation, with the rest to be slowly released as rewards for those who provide network security over the next 120 years. This means Bitcoin is a deflationary system, with a transparent and known monetary policy, where no dictator or CEO can decide to print more and devalue everyone else's money. Bitcoin's anonymous creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, was quite clear that Bitcoin was supposed to be an alternative to central banking and absolute government control of money, even inserting a critique of quantitative easing into the first Genesis block of the Bitcoin blockchain to prove the point. And what's wrong with that? Monopolized control of money may seem normal to you today, but in reality, the practice causes misery for billions of people around the world who are caught under hyperinflation, currency crises, financial surveillance, sanctions, and capital controls. It also makes it easy for governments to print money to go to war and commit violence. We can do better. Not wanting to miss the most common line of attack against Bitcoin, Girard mentions that it's a waste of energy. But here he and all the rest of the critics who blindly repeat an argument sourced mainly from a non-expert's blog are missing the big picture. Today, more than 75% of Bitcoin's energy usage is estimated to come from renewable resources, a number projected to only increase into the future. Nearly half of all mining is done in a part of China where power is almost exclusively hydroelectric. So while, yes, Bitcoin does use a lot of energy, in the same way as Saifedean Ammous has pointed out that the car uses more energy than the horse carriage, and the refrigerator more than an ice bucket, and a washing machine more than arduous hand labor, and a modern hospital more than a medieval field tent. It is already unlocking new sources of hydro, geothermal, solar, and wind power that go otherwise unused or unreachable, hopefully helping us toward the end of the hydrocarbon age. Girard characterizes Bitcoin as a project promoting libertarianism. While it's certainly true that you can have a libertarian appreciation for Bitcoin, given that it gives one financial sovereignty and liberates you from government control, one can also have a progressive appreciation. In my view, Bitcoin is a similar phenomenon to democracy and the internet, technologies which respectively smashed the tyranny of political power and corporate control of knowledge. Through democracy, citizens are able to check the power of kings and dictators, and through the internet, citizens outside of the government and the richest classes are now able to have a strong public voice and have unfettered access to all of the world's knowledge. In the same way, Bitcoin will break the government and corporate monopoly on money. In 100 years, humans will likely look back at today and see a time when a small handful of elites controlled money as a backwards idea, just like the idea of political tyranny or state-controlled news. Girard saves his favorite argument for last, that Bitcoin is a shadowy network that will surely be used by criminals and drug dealers. But remember, the same types of fear-based arguments were made by kings and elites and dictators when the people demanded that they step down and share power, or by big telephone companies and news organizations and propaganda regimes at the dawn of the internet. But instead of bringing instability and terror and crime to our societies, democracy has empowered half our world and sparked historic advances in innovation, prosperity, peace, and social welfare. And instead of becoming a criminal domain, the internet has put the sum of human knowledge into anyone's hand, giving a global megaphone to investigative journalists and a world encyclopedia to aspiring students. And while Girard tries to tie Bitcoin to evildoers, He fails to mention that virtually all financial crime and drug trafficking is committed inside the existing, quote, official financial system, where trillions of dollars of corruption occur, aided and abetted by banks like HSBC and Wells Fargo. Watch Escaping the Global Banking Cartel, a standout talk by Andreas Antonopoulos, and you'll learn more about why Bitcoin is a way out of our current system, which is exclusionary and unjust, and tends to prey on the weak and disenfranchised while letting the corrupt Davos crowd walk free. In fact, for all his do-gooder consumer protection positioning, Girard misses the key human rights aspects of Bitcoin completely. Whether you are trapped under centralized payment schemes like WeChat used to micro-track your lives, or whether your newspaper's bank account has been frozen by a dictator, or whether the U.S. government has unfairly put broad sanctions on your country, punishing you for crimes your rulers committed, Bitcoin is a way out. The greatest potential that Bitcoin has is to help the most vulnerable on this planet, those without bank accounts, identities, or access to the financial system. Now, with just a phone and an internet connection, anyone can receive Bitcoin from anyone else in the world, in minutes, for a small fee, with no possibility of censorship or seizure, without needing to ask permission from anyone, and without needing to prove an identity. In coming years, as infrastructure and local liquidity and exchange points grow, Bitcoin will have a major impact on foreign and humanitarian aid. Individuals, charities, and democratic governments will no longer need to comply or even deal with the dictators who rule over most of the world's poorest people. As Coinbase realizes with its Give Crypto program, we'll be able to sidestep this old infrastructure completely and transact with aid recipients directly. We can already analyze local exchange data to see that despite Bitcoin's declining price in the past year, usage has increased in authoritarian societies like Belarus, Venezuela, Kazakhstan, and Egypt. Perhaps the most shocking thing about Bitcoin is that so few know about it. 10 years since the project began, it is estimated that less than 1% of the global population has ever interacted with Bitcoin. Unlike the modern financial system, which is run by a kind of aristocracy and only permits selective access, Bitcoin is completely open to everyone. It cannot discriminate. Literally anyone can use free online tools to learn how Bitcoin works, send and receive Bitcoin, and even learn to code and contribute to the Bitcoin software itself, helping to steer the direction of the future economy. Here's the best part. You don't need to go to Harvard or be a VC in Silicon Valley or have a 30-year career in economics or central banking to help lead the next financial revolution. Most world-changing technologies are dismissed by the crowd at first. Consider the telephone, which no one wanted to buy, the car, which surely couldn't work on our horse roads, the plane, which couldn't possibly be safe, or the internet, which was destined to fail. Remember the words of Paul Krugman, who said that, quote, by 2005, it will become clear that the internet's impact on the economy has been no greater than the fax machine. Any fundamental technology, from the fridge to the credit card, follows an adoption S-curve. And at the beginning of the S, there are always plenty of Luddites and skeptics. Eventually, the curve goes exponential, and the technology spreads throughout humanity. It's hard to imagine a more fair or democratic idea than the fact that anyone today, regardless of their location, gender, language, age, level of education, or wealth, can get meaningfully involved at the ground level of Bitcoin, an exponential technology that is still at the bottom of its adoption S-curve. The only thing stopping you is you. Perhaps it's too much for Girard to grasp this, as he writes from the cozy confines of London. But whether it's in the Philippines, Nigeria, Turkey, Venezuela, or Palestine, there are people who don't have his rights, freedoms, and trust in their financial system. And they are increasingly using Bitcoin, the most secure and sovereign form of money on Earth. Thanks to Dan Held and Monsieur Mamadov for their feedback. Great little piece. If it wasn't obvious, because I didn't actually say it at the beginning, this is from last year, so this has got some age on it now, and this was before COVID days, so I'm sure there would be many, many more examples of what it's like to not have the freedom to do things or to, you know, spend money or control, you know, capital controls, like all of these issues that I feel like have gone crazy full force in 2020. And, you know, he might have mentioned the $3 trillion extra dollars in money printing and the QE infinity that's going on now, and the inflation that's coming to the U.S. dollar, which in Michael Saylor's interview, that's one of the things that I talk about, or that he talks about, that I just thought was so crazy, was thinking about inflation from the context of retiring on your assets, and just the interest rate is straight manipulating the interest rate down is a form of inflation. Like, that is a direct sign of inflation, that capital assets, that treasuries and like the overnight repo markets and these things that savings accounts that should pay you interest. So that if you have $10 million, if you've saved up this enormous amount of capital over your lifetime, then when you're 60, when you're 70, you can actually just earn an interest rate on it and retire. But that if that interest rate is 0%, if that interest rate is 0.1%, you suddenly need 10, 25, 50 times as much capital saved up over your lifetime to retire. Your retirement just got robbed from you. Everything that you produced your whole life just got obliterated because somebody else didn't like that they have to pay off their debt to you. You are the one that's owed, and they don't want to pay it back, ignoring all the other things, and that right there is just criminal. But this article by Gerard, what was the name? I already forgot. David Gerard. Okay. Forget Bitcoin, try your mattress. It's really kind of the most basic of arguments against it. And one of the things he points out, Alex Gladstein points out right at the beginning here, is that almost every major Bitcoin critic just couldn't explain anything about it. You know, like his meaning or whatever, that they haven't done their homework and literally could not pass a basic quiz on topics like mining, wallets, or nodes. And that's what's funny, is that this is pretty common. Like, this is essentially ubiquitous against serious Bitcoin critics. They could not explain to you how Bitcoin works. They have an idea of what Bitcoin is, and they could not be bothered to go figure it out. Their impression or skepticism, their impression of it is so low, or their skepticism is so high of it, that it's like, I shouldn't even have to go read about it to be able to write this entire article about why it's stupid. But one of the first points that Alex brings up, I just find it's hilarious, is what use is there for money where you have to control your own password? And all I can think is that that is going to be the Paul Krugman quote, internet quote, of Bitcoin. Like, that statement is literally one of the most profound things about Bitcoin. That is what makes it revolutionary, is that you have a private key and it's yours. The not your keys, not your Bitcoin, your keys, your Bitcoin, like, that dichotomy is unique among monetary assets in the history of the world. And that is unbelievable to just so cheaply dismiss one of the most profound things about Bitcoin from a sovereignty dynamic, from a what control or what a level of ownership, property rights, that you have property rights that are external to everything in the world. If Bitcoin tells you it is yours, it is yours. And as long as you can protect that password, not a soul in the world can take that from you. And our current political and macro financial conditions could not be a better example of how important that is, how unique that is as an asset. And I think Gladstein is right here, is that the only way that you could think that this is meaningless is to be in a ridiculous position of privilege. And I hate that word. Like, I think that's stupid, but from just like, you could not be more comfortable if you think that is not an interesting aspect of Bitcoin. And this is one of those things too, that like when we talk about, when we got into Gigi's piece on Bitcoin's UX and how there are certain things that you can't get around, like the public-private key system is one of them. Like, you're not going to be able to totally obfuscate away that, because that is the thing that makes sovereignty in Bitcoin its thing, like a characteristic. That is what defends the nature of sovereignty in Bitcoin. So if you obscure that away behind a UX or a service or something, you're almost invariably, almost by necessity, you are removing that control from the user. You're either putting it in a service or, you know, doing some sort of a backup. And just like Gerard talks about in his article, is that you're giving your keys over to somebody else and threatening your very ownership of it, because, you know, you're handing it to somebody like the CEO of Quadriga, who was holding all of the keys themselves and then died, which, by the way, was a horrible setup. Like, that he just had all the keys entirely to himself and there was no backup or multi-sig or whatever. But again, this was 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, at least. So there's a degree of transition into multi-sig actually becoming like a norm. And if you're an irresponsible and, you know, untrusting like CEO, it's very, like, it's kind of inevitable that we're going to have that sort of a situation, you know, a CEO dies and takes the keys of all that Bitcoin with him. Caravan wasn't out yet. Unchained wasn't really a big thing. Like multi-sig, it's a kind of amazing actually how far multi-signature and these backup schemes and stuff have become later on. And there's actually something we're going to talk about in an episode coming up this week about vaults and covenants and some of these things that are coming to Bitcoin, that everybody's so hyper-focused on Lightning, which is great. I freaking love Lightning. And that's kind of that, like, in-your-face use case. But I think there are some really profound things coming to the Bitcoin base layer that are really, really interesting from that context of how to prevent those kinds of things from happening, how to prevent it from, how to essentially always have some sort of clawback in the case of a hack or a, you know, some... basically, like, you know, the beauty of Lightning is that there's an insurance clause in the channel so that you can always redeem if, you know, something goes wrong or someone tries to contest. And obviously there's, you know, attack vectors and there's things that you got to worry about, but that's the model of Lightning. Well, you can actually do the same thing with just a Bitcoin address. You can essentially have an insurance clause. You can have a time lock into how long it takes to withdraw from this one address. Let's say it's 2 weeks. And during that mode, if you have a backup key or a couple of family members' keys or something like that, they don't have the power to take the coins, but they can, after it's executed, to withdraw from like the main account and the time lock is activated, that they can actually withdraw it back to a different set of keys. So that there's like this predestined, you know, insurance exit clause sort of thing. So there's a lot of really powerful tools like that coming, which I think will be huge for custody and stuff, when particularly when I think Bitcoin is going to be, Bitcoin is really going to take off as a collateral asset, something that you can put up in like a house. You know, a house is collateral for your mortgage. You say, I can get this loan at a much lower interest rate than a normal loan because you take my house if something goes wrong, or you sell my house or whatever. You have value to back the loan. Same with Bitcoin. I think this is going to be a big thing, particularly as, you know, yields and cash yields go to crap. I think there'll be a speculative attack on the dollar. And this would be an amazing tool to use. And services just like Unchained, not a sponsor of the show or anything, I just, you know, like, they're the best example of it because you can actually look at your keys. or you can actually see the balance and hold your own keys of what you're holding up to collateral. So it's a really interesting business model. And they've just released an article recently that I read. Actually, I might read that on the show. But about expanding and making like better models explicitly for business custody, which was just right on the, you know, right on the other side of Michael Saylor making this announcement with MicroStrategy of a $400 million investment in Bitcoin. So good timing for Unchained. Back to the article, though. Gerard says, this was one thing that got me. And Gladstein did hit it, but I don't think he hit it kind of in... he didn't write a whole article about it, which you could easily do. You could write a book about this ridiculous statement. That Gerard claimed that Bitcoin takes us to the past where you could lose your savings if your banker ran off with your money. And he starts off by saying that, well, this is not the past, but the present for people in Zimbabwe, Venezuela, and under, you know, certain regimes like Russia and China and, other despotic governments that literally just exert like totalitarian control over their citizens, and really in the U.S. too. I mean, look at civil asset forfeiture and some of the crazy stuff that's going on there, and like what level of recourse do you have in even situations just corporations like PayPal and Venmo and these things freezing accounts and confiscating funds. Like, people lose their businesses and get wrapped up in years trying to get this shit back. Go to the, you know, the subreddit for PayPal, like nightmare stories. It's really ridiculous what this situation is, but he's talking about, Gerard is specifically talking about, like, oh, the bank is insured. But this is exactly what leads to the horrible moral hazards of banks being ridiculously irresponsible with customers' money. If they know the customer is going to be bailed out without their expense, that they don't have to purchase the insurance for their customers, if they know their bank is going to be bailed out by the government, because the government can just print and loan out trillions more just to cover losses, to cover interest that they can't afford, to cover their leveraged positions because they're freaking idiots. What possible incentive do they have to be responsible? To actually not lend themselves to the hilt? To not max out their credit cards and then issue another credit card and require the government to pay it off at a lower interest rate? How do you think we get these huge 70, 80 trillion dollar debt bubbles? That's how you get them. It's a recipe to make that situation. Like, if you gave me a blank slate and said, how would you create this? Like, that would be a part of the plan. The reason in the olden days you would lose your savings if your banker ran off with your money is because we actually had to have reserves to give out loans. You actually could, banks couldn't create money out of thin air, and neither could the government. Money was actually sound. That's a past I actually do want to go to. Because frankly, I'm sick of the consequences of the system that quote-unquote fixed it. But, you know, how could Gerard be expected to know that when one of his other complaints about Bitcoin is that it has a limited supply? Of course, deflation is bad. I'm not sure if y'all saw the IMF video about how inflation is bad if if the price of chairs fall, because that means people aren't gonna use chairs. We're not gonna buy a chair this year for $100 because we can get it next year for $90, and we're all just gonna stand. We're gonna stand for the next 365 days until the price of chairs fall. And I can't remember who it was. It was one of you guys, I think, that commented underneath it that I'm just going to buy my coffee tomorrow when the price is lower. Said no one ever. That cracked me up. But you know what deflation is? It means that it takes less resources to make the same amount of value. That's what it means. It means the economy is more efficient. Like, that's why prices adjust down. And no, it is not bad for the economy any more than it is bad for the computer industry. The computer industry has been, every industry that is becoming a information technology is being met with a powerful deflationary force in the economy. Highly recommend Jeff Booth's book, The Price of Tomorrow. That really kind of gets into this. But, you know, the fact that an iPhone is worth 50% of its value the next year or 2 years down the road does not hurt the tech industry. It is an accelerant. It is something that keeps them pushing so hard, so fast into the next realm. And the reason it is deflationary is because the technology is getting better. Like, if we could produce chairs for 50 cent, like nice, really solid, high quality chairs for 50 cent, you know what it would do? It would make everybody stupidly wealthy, because we wouldn't have to waste hours of our day producing just so that we had a place to sit down. It would literally lower the price of food. It would lower the price of travel and cars. Everything that required a chair or needed people sitting down in the process would get lower cost. When you lower the prices of goods and you lower the amount of production and time and human labor that it takes to produce something that is then used as the input to another thing that people make or some other leisure or something that people value or need, what you do is you make it more accessible to people. You make that next good cheaper and all prices push down. It's not bad for the economy, because anybody who actually produced, who actually has savings, now is able to afford more, and fixed wages get more valuable over time. Why? Because we all work to make the economy more productive. It should get more valuable over time. What else are we doing here? If we're not making the economy better at doing the things we need the economy to do, why the hell are we wasting our time? That is literally the point of working, to make our situation better. I'm not doing it for fun. I'm doing it so that something good comes out of it. But we have a system where the banking system and the government and people who can counterfeit currency, who can issue it at a whim, can essentially soak up all of that excess value. And that's how you get stagnant wages and extremely fast price increases across the board. And we're lucky with the dollar. We're lucky with the dollar. As damaging as it is, and as horrible as the consequences have been for the last 40 to 50 years, the dollar being the reserve asset allows us to export all of this pain. We get to push it onto China and onto the Middle East and everybody who's buying oil. Other countries don't get that privilege. Venezuela doesn't get that privilege. Japan didn't get that privilege. Those countries had to eat their inflation. Ours will come due. The bill will come due. It's coming due right now. We get to see what it looks like. Just like Michael Saylor said, you know, try to retire on an interest rate today. You don't have interest rates. You don't have interest on anything. In an economy where savings, we are desperate for savings, where we have absolutely no excess capital, whatever, anywhere, where everybody is drowning in debt, there is nobody paying anyone for savings. That's retarded. And it is explicitly because of the nature of our money. And Bitcoin fixes that. 21 million is the reason it fixes it. But you know, the journey to getting there and understanding all that stuff is a very, very long one. And it's not really much to expect most people in the mainstream to have any idea about any of this stuff. You know, I get worked up about it, but I can't really hold it against them most of the time. Like, what the hell do they know, right? They answered the questions on their quizzes and tests and got the gold star, and, you know, they just did what they were rewarded for. Incentives, right? Of course they're going to end up knowing the wrong thing if they're taught the wrong thing and then patted on the back every time they repeat it. So, luckily we have this thing. Luckily, we have Bitcoin, open and accessible to anyone. No barriers, no discrimination. Like, it literally can't discriminate. That's what Gladstein said in the article. Like, it just doesn't have a clue about anyone or anything that is using it. It is an open, global protocol that is as accessible as an internet protocol can be, even without the internet. Now, with satellite dish, with radio waves and, you know, new technology that's coming with mesh networks, it's getting more and more accessible and very potentially could be immune to an internet catastrophe in the not too distant future. That's infrastructure, baby. That's a real censorship resistant decentralized network, if I've ever heard of one. And I hope it happens. I'm probably going to be getting my satellite node up in the not too distant future. That's a project that's probably as soon as I get my 3D printer figured out, because I have lost a burned out a not a capacitor, a fuse, I think, on the 3D printer in my attempt to upgrade it to 24 volts. So I'm going to do that or whatever. So next project will probably be a satellite node. And I'm going to set up Umbral because I haven't gotten to play with that yet. And now like Bobo and some other people in the group are bragging about, I got Umbral set up. And you shut your mouth. You shut your mouth. But yeah, so I hope to be joining the Bitcoin network external to the internet in the not too distant future. And what a wonderful thing it is to have that and to have that mindset. And there's actually a great article we're going to be reading this week kind of about that, about, you know, how we kill Lightning Network and thus where we may be finding solutions to those problems. I love it. Just like with Shinobi's great piece from the end of last week is, you know, we have to be the ones to figure out all the ways that we can kill or disrupt Bitcoin so that we can build the solutions before we need them. Because that's how you make something unkillable. And that's what Bitcoin is, baby. So thank you all so much for listening. Another shout out to our supporter for the show, Hexa Wallet. I actually just sent some transaction from Hexa to my BTC pay just a little while ago. Going to open up a couple of new channels on Lightning. It really is a great wallet, particularly with like the language I talk about, like with the checking and the savings wallet. It's just really cool to kind of have those different levels of security, and the ability to use your contacts as like partial backups is just a cool feature. Like I said earlier, I'm extending an offer to anybody who downloads the wallet. I will be your contact and share one of your keys. Obviously, I don't have control over your coins or anything, but I will share a part of your key with your seedless recovery. So don't forget to hit me up on Twitter at the Crypto Economy or at Bitcoin Audible, either one. Just hit me up. DMs are open. Add me as a contact and we'll do it. I'll help you walk through it if you have any issues. Again, that is Hexa Wallet. You can find them at hexawallet.io or on the Google Play and Apple App Store. And thank you so much to my patrons for supporting this show and sharing this out with everybody in the Bitcoin space. You guys have been extraordinary in showing support for Bitcoin Audible, and I absolutely love it. Thank you so much. I will be back with another episode for you tomorrow. Got some really fun stuff. I've already got like 3 episodes in the bag, and the first episode of another show, and I can't wait to share it with you guys, so don't miss it. This is Bitcoin Audible, where you're going to learn anything and everything about Bitcoin and hear all the best works in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.